So my idea is to speak for a while and then invite questions from you. First of all, let me say that I'm very glad indeed to be here again and to see each time I come a few more people in the Shrine Group, which is very nice, and to meet people I've been meeting over a year or more again and again. So what I want to talk to you about tonight are some reflections arising out of my reading of the Buddhist scriptures, the Pali Canon. You probably all know that the Buddha spoke, and there were no written records of what he said from his own time. There were no tape recorders. Probably the Buddha himself could not write and read, because at that time it was reserved for the sacred texts and for commercial purposes. Writing performed only those functions. So somebody like him didn't learn to read and write, and he was not surrounded by people who could write. And the story is that his closest disciple, Ananda, closest in, well, you might say personal terms, remembered all the teachings that he gave, and after the Buddha's death, recounted them, checked them with others, and then handed them on to others. And they were handed on orally for 300 or 400 years, and then they were written down in Sri Lanka when it was feared that they were going to be lost. It's a very, very rich store of material. I should say that the same material was passed on in other languages. The language that we refer to as Pali is an early Indian language that is related to Sanskrit. It's a popular language. It's a people's language, not an educated language. It's close as we can get to what the Buddha himself would have spoken, probably 200 or 300 years after him. It's a bit like, 18th century English in relation to present day English. But the words of the Buddha were passed on in other languages, other Indian languages, including Sanskrit, and other Prakrits, which were popular languages. And some of those were transmitted into China, and in China there's a collection of the same early material, but in Chinese from the Sanskrit. Anyway, I'm just filling you in a little bit of background. It's an enormously rich body of material, hundreds and hundreds of different occasions when the Buddha taught, and I very strongly recommend just dipping into it. It's not always presented in a very approachable form, partly because of the problems of translation, partly because it was handed down orally, so it was arranged for easy memorization. Is that the right word? Is that a word? Yes, memorization. And that often also with a certain rhythm to it. So you get a lot of stock phrases, a lot of repetition. Everything is said 5 times, and repetitions are carried right the way through a whole sutta. But if you can put up with the rather unpleasing literary form of the documents, it's an enormous wealth of material, and you could easily pass a lifetime just going over it and finding things that you didn't know were there. And it's one of my pleasures in life. I haven't been doing it more recently, but quite often when I get up in the morning, I'm one of those infuriating people who wakes up fairly fresh, not like some of my friends, who are on definitely 10% power for a couple of hours. Now I wake up with the needle on full. It's a terrible thing. But the only trouble is I'm usually a little bit irritable. That's another question. Anyway, I've taken to the habit of getting up in the morning and having a cup of tea and just opening the pages of the various volumes of the Pali Canon. And more recently, I've been especially concentrating on a collection called Anguttara Nikaya, which is a collection of things in progressive order. So you get everything that's to do with one, everything that's to do with two, everything that's to do with three, so on up to 12. It's a little formulaic, but it means you get this enormous variety, because under five, you'll get all sorts of various things. So you'll read your way through the fives, and you're here, there, and everywhere. And you get the Buddha's enormous practical wisdom, as well as his very, very deep spiritual understanding, his very great understanding of other human beings and the way they work. You know, for instance, you get the four ways to answer a question. You know, you can either answer a question with a direct response, or you can answer a question with analysis. You know, I remember when I was studying philosophy, not a million miles from here, you know, the great, it depends what you mean by. That's answering with an analysis, or, you know, when you said that, did you mean? Or you can answer it with a counter question. Or you can basically refuse to answer it. Well, it doesn't actually say that. What you do is you defer the answer. So I'll think about that later. So, politician's answer, maybe. But in this case, it's presumably because this is not the right moment to go into that. The atmosphere isn't right. The conditions are not right. Or you just think that the person asking it isn't asking for the right reasons. Mm-hmm. So sometimes the Buddha would just refuse to go into something because he just didn't think it was being approached in the right way. You know, sometimes you get questions and you feel that that's not really the question. There's something else going on. So just as an example of the, you know, it's not spiritual in a sense, it's just common sense applied to the ordinary business of things. So very, very interesting material. And yes, I found some surprising material that in a way, it seems strange that we don't know much more about it. So I'm going to talk to you a little bit about one of these, maybe another one if you're very good. Don't ask me awkward questions, which I have to refuse to answer. this is the five things that everybody should contemplate. The five reflections that everybody should engage in. Seems rather pertinent, doesn't it, you know, because we're presumably everybody, or part of everybody. And I've never seen them worked out in or discussed much in any other context. You get something similar in Tibetan Buddhism with the ordinary foundations, but it's a slightly different list, a slightly different take on things. So I'm going to tell you what those five are, say a little bit about them and why the Buddha suggests them, and yes, one in particular I want to go into in much greater depth. And then after the appropriate short leg stretch, euphemistic leg stretch, you can ask me some questions and I'll see whether I deign to answer them or not. Or put them off or analyse them. Or just have to admit I have no idea what you're talking about. So there are five ordinary, or the five reflections that everybody should engage in are, first of all, I am subject to aging. I will grow old. Secondly, I am subject to sickness. I will become sick. Thirdly, I am subject to death. I will die. Fourthly, I must depart, I must be separated from everything that is dear to me and that is beloved, that I love. And fifthly, I am heir to my own karma. I'll read this out because it's quite interestingly put. I am owner of my actions, heir of my actions. Actions are the womb from which I have sprung. Actions are my relations. Actions are my protectors. Whatever actions I do, whether good or bad, of these I shall become heir. So these are the five basic reflections that the Buddha says we should all engage in. So first of all, they're reflections about the basic facts of life, the nature of this life. The fact that we cannot escape old age. We cannot escape sickness. We cannot escape death. The Buddha said that these are antidotes to three intoxications. The intoxication of youth, not afflicting many of us here tonight, I'm afraid. You can still be intoxicated, though, with what's left of it. It's odd that there could even be an intoxication with not being very old. Intoxication with sickness. Intoxication with health, and the intoxication with life itself. So the Buddha said that when you're young, especially when you're healthy, when you're alive, you don't really see what the situation is. Just as when you're drunk, you don't really know what's going on, and you bump into things, and you mistake things, or if you're intoxicated with some sort of hallucinogenic, you distort your experience and you think things are real that are not real. Because we're young, because we've got plenty of energy, because we're in a good state of health, and because we're alive, we kind of forget that this is just a temporary condition. For us to be intoxicated and not recognize that these three are there means that we do not live accurately, as it were. We do not live into relationship to the way things really are. So because you're intoxicated with youth, you don't prepare yourself for life's progressions. You don't prepare yourself for a life where you have less energy, where you're not able to do so much. You don't use the energy that you have when you're young. You know, they say that the energy of youth is wasted on the young, and the wisdom of old age is wasted on the old. If you had the energy of youth and the wisdom of old age, you'd be in a really good condition. So the point is that our youth, or frankly, brothers and sisters, our relative youth, is disguises from us the real facts of things. We get old, don't we? It happens. If we're lucky, it happens. And it does mean a diminution in one's energy. It means that you can't remember names. My main affliction, especially these wretched order names, where everybody's basically called some combination of Padma or Vajra or something like that. You just can't. I can't get on with them. I just say you. That fellow there who works with me, I never get his name right. As you get older, your powers diminish, and there are quite a lot that you need to get under your belt before old age gets under your belt, or makes your belt expand rapidly. You need to make sure that you've really used the opportunities that youth gives you, the opportunities of a, for instance, relatively unfixed mind. The mind is much more flexible, much more free. You feel more life opening up, in a way more optimistic. You've got lots of energy, often. Not everybody, of course. But youth is a time when energy is to spare. You need to use that opportunity to the best advantage. And, of course, the Buddha is talking against the background. The great assumption behind all this is the fact, as it were, the sixth reflection, which is the real meaning and purpose of this human life, which is the realization of of enlightenment, the realization of Buddhahood, which is the greatest fulfillment that one can experience, the resolution of all one's troubles, all one's disturbances, the final recognition of the deep mystery of things. So, yes, you need to use youth to make sure that you've got the factors in place that will enable you to gain a deeper recognition of the way things are. Otherwise, we waste our opportunities. We waste them, and we end up not merely not going down the right path, so to speak, but we go down paths that are, at the very least, a bit beside the point. We go down cul-de-sacs, and we use our energies in ways that really waste them or distort them. We become, to some extent, lessened or distorted by the uses to which we put our energy. I wasted too much time taking drugs. Fortunately, not very much time. But, you know, that youthful period, a lot of it, right here in North London, not far from here. I can even tell you where I got my LSD from the corner here. But, you know, I could have done without that. It took some time to recover. That time, although I did gain something from it, some sense of a higher mystery, a deeper mystery to life, I also did some damage to myself. And it took time, not too much time, to recover. I didn't get very deeply into it all. But one wastes one's opportunities. You know, and when I was at university, I was at the Kentish Town branch of this university here, and I didn't use the time at all well. I could have been building a much better intellectual foundation, which would have stood me in good stead, particularly for communication, for communicating the Dhamma, but I just wasted the time by and large. Don't know how I got a degree. That's a good question. So yes, youth is if you've got it, what you have got left of it, the energy of youth, is to be used wisely, used well, and to be used for your own and others' benefit, because later it won't be there, or it'll be there in diminishing quantities. Something I personally experienced relatively young, a mere 62. But I realised I can do everything I used to do, but I have nothing to waste. I have no energy to waste. I've got to harbour my energy really carefully and use it very carefully indeed. I see it with Sangharakshita, who's 85, and it's amazing meeting him, because you feel as if you're meeting a young man. The energy of his mind is a youthful energy, but he just doesn't have it for very long. You know, I used to work for him, I was his secretary, and he used to just keep going the whole day. But now he can keep going for a couple of hours and then he has to send you off because he's running out of energy. But he husbands it so carefully. In a way, you need to have used your energy well to keep using your energy well as it diminishes, if you see what I mean. So this is something for all to reflect on, whether we're really quite far on from youth or not. There are some who classify as youths and some who classify it as not so long after it, and a few of us who are definitely beyond it. But what there is of it, use well. Life is astonishingly short. I don't know whether anybody else experiences this. I just find the days flashing by, just one by one by one, flashing by. And it won't be long. It won't last that long. So we need to use it well. And so, of course, a very, very important message of the Buddha Dhamma. So a lovely story that I remember from Zen sources of a very old Zen master whose sister came to him and said, we've got a problem in our family. my son is an absolute waster on. He's just hanging around in a Kentish town smoking dope and taking LSD, and he won't get on with his degree, you know what I mean. And, you know, please can you help? So the master said, well, just wait, I'll come and visit you, I'll come and visit you at home. They lived in a village far away from the temple. So he came, walked to the temple, you can imagine, with his staff, very slowly, walked to the temple. Maybe took him several days to get there. He stayed for a few days with the family. And then on the last day, the sister was getting very anxious. Nothing was happening. He wasn't taking him for the now look here, boy, talk. No, nothing was happening. So on the last day, the master was leaving, and he sat down, and the boy was just was nearby, and he said, you know, come, can you help me do up my shoes? I'm getting very old now, and I can't do up my shoes. And so the boy helped him to do up his shoes. The master left, and from that moment on, the boy was a reformed man. In other words, he's absorbed the lesson from the master by experience. He'd seen in the way the master behaved that there's somebody worth listening to, and he'd got the message just from that simple message. At his age, it was difficult to tie his shoes. So we need to get that message. While we can easily bend on the floor and tie the shoes, we need to get the message. Of course, yes, sickness is, again, a very similar sort of message. I don't know, different people have very different experiences in that way. I've been very fortunate for myself, I've experienced very little sickness myself. But many of you even here, maybe have experienced a lot of sickness through your lives. But if you don't experience sickness, or when you're not experiencing sickness, you forget. You forget that it happens. You forget that it will happen. And you become intoxicated with health. You think that this is the way you're always going to be, that nothing can stop you. So in a very similar way to the way I talked about the recognition of the aging, the necessity of aging, we need to recognise that sickness can come at any moment. And in just the same way, we need to reflect that when you're sick, it's very hard to exert energy often. Sometimes there may be a lot of pain. Sometimes there may be a lessening of consciousness. Some illness actually affects your mental functioning. You can't think clearly, you can't reflect clearly. You may not even be able to remain steady-minded. You can always practice. You can practice in any situation, but if you haven't built sufficient foundation, it's very difficult to do it when you're sick. If you've developed a great deal of mindfulness, even when you're sick, you can remain awake. You can remain alert, mindful. But if you haven't built the basis for it, sickness may mean that you're unable to use even that experience. So sickness is bound to happen. It's not so bad here. You know, I spend almost half my year in India, and sickness is much nearer the surface there. Everybody suffers quite acute sickness quite often. Most people have some sort of stomach problems. So the water supply is not reliable, most people that I'm in contact with don't have the resources to buy bottled water, or don't have the resources to buy a purification plant. And just to give you a horrifying story, I saw recently somebody had tested the water supply in Pune, which is a very, it's one of the silicon cities of India. And there was very high fecal contamination of the water supply in Pune. So don't drink the water. But you have to drink it. I don't have to, but my friends do. and it's going to affect their stomach. So there you're much more aware of the speed with which sickness can come upon you. And there I do notice that people are much more aware of the ever-present lurking threat of sickness, if not for yourself, then for your family, because that can be also very, very restricting in various ways. So sickness is part of life. It's inevitable. We have bodies that are complex organisms, and they're bound to suffer injury and sickness at some point, even if it's only the odd cold or whatever. And eventually it's going to all break down. That we've already dealt well. No, that's what we're going to deal with next. The last thing is reflecting on death. This is a very important Buddhist reflection. It's very strongly enjoined upon us that we recognise the nature of this life. You don't really understand this life unless you recognise its juxtaposition with death. You cannot have life unless you have death. They belong together. If you need, according to the Buddhist approach, you need to sort of take death into your life so that you live with death, not in a morbid sense, not in the sense that you're, turning into a goth and having skulls for your earrings sort of thing. Can do that, that's another question. It's rather fun. But it's a question of recognizing the nature of life, that nature is that life is a brief sort of interlude, which must end in what we call death. It's not something to be feared. It's not something necessarily frightening. In a way, it isn't anything. But we need to take it in, because then it puts our lives in perspective. Then what we're doing alive takes on meaning. Because you know, if you know you're going to die and you take that into your life, life becomes a different affair. Very, very struck recently, a very good old friend of mine who first came along to Buddhism at classes I led in Archway, in the predecessor to the North London Buddhist Centre, Punya. Some of you may have heard of an order member called Punya. And he came to see me a couple of years ago because he'd been diagnosed with secondary cancer, and he'd been told that there's no chance of him living beyond six months. And he was living in the States, he came back to England and he wanted to see me. And I got that sort of, slight discomfort about sort of being with somebody who knows they're going to die. Not that actually I don't know I'm going to die, but who really knows he's going to die. But it was one of the most wonderful encounters I've ever had. Because he said that discovering that he the writing was on the wall and that he knew pretty much when it was going to happen had just been a complete liberation. It had just meant that he dropped everything that didn't matter. And he said almost everything he'd been engaged with didn't matter. That all the things that he thought were important were not important. That the vividness of a single moment escaped him. And he was always living for the future. And now there was no future. So he could just live for friendship. He said that was the most important thing to him now, his contact with friends. He'd come all the way to England to just say goodbye to friends like me. And, not in a sad way at all, but a really joyous way, because he'd just appreciated now the real nature of this life. And I live in a beautiful, if rather wet, Welsh mountainside. And an oxymoron, isn't it? Welsh, wet Welsh hillside. And a very, very beautiful lecture when he was there. It was gloriously sunny. It was really peaceful. And he was just weeping at the beauty of the scene, because the knowledge of his death had released him from the sort of acquisition of things. He didn't need anything from it. He didn't want anything from it. He wasn't there for anything. He was just there enjoying the experience of friendship, the beauty of the scenery, enjoying communicating his experience, listening to my experience. Well, it's a real lesson to me. I thought, well, this is what the Buddha is trying to get at. That if we take the fact of death into our lives, it means we abandon what is not relevant. We abandon what is just a way of fulfilling egoistic desires, trying to make ourselves important, yes, trying to chase after things that you can't take with you, and just enjoying the most important things of our life: beauty, friendship, meaning, generosity, the real qualities that make life meaningful, make life worthwhile. So, if we can take death in that way into our lives, not in a morbid way, not in a frightened way — there's nothing to be frightened of. I've seen enough death to know there's nothing to be frightened of in it. In fact, it can be very, very beautiful. Very beautiful indeed. I just talked to somebody about this yesterday. I don't know, anybody's keen on music? The music of Richard Strauss. Do you know the four last songs? Which are, if you haven't heard them, just listen to them. But they're based on poems by Hermann Hesse. Three of them are, and one of them is called Autumn. It's most exquisitely beautiful. It's sort of sad, but it's not sad, it's melancholy. Mm. A sense of the dying sunset, that the sun fading, the feeling is of beauty, of the great beauty of the fading of things. It's autumnal, in a word. As the trees turn, they become more beautiful, the leaves floating on the wind. So it's a very, very beautiful piece of music. And interestingly enough, I hadn't come across it. I knew his work, but I didn't know these. And I went to Christmas Humphreys, who's really the doyen of English Buddhism. He was the one who really made Buddhism more popular in England. And I went to his funeral, and as his coffin went through the curtains into the crematorium, the ovens, they played this music, and an extraordinary sense of joy, as well as sort of parting, melancholy of parting. Something very, very fine, very beautiful about it. So I don't think we need to approach death in that morbid way. Death is only morbid or frightening if we're clinging to life. And what we're clinging to in life is something that actually can't help us, can't really give us satisfaction or pleasure. We're not dealing with the things that life really delivers to us that are enriching and satisfying. Just an image has come into my mind. I went recently to IKEA. One has to go every now and again. I went with a friend, an order member, Sangha Deva, some of you may know. And he just came to help me to carry the things to the van and take them down where they're going and put them up. So he was just there to help me. I knew what I was going to get. I was walking around quite purposefully. I always go in through the exit and walk counter to the general flow. It's a bizarre experience because people get into a special state of mind, IKEA consciousness, which is dangerous, actually. If you go against the flow, you're in danger of getting knocked down by people who are only half there. They're just lost in dreams. Dreams of a sort of Swedish Heavenish hell. We're walking around, and I suddenly noticed that Sangadeva was walking beside me with a big grin on his face. I thought, oh, you know, seen something you like. And he said, no. I just realised that there's nothing here I want. And it's the most wonderfully pleasurable experience. Just walking around Ikea, just enjoying the people, enjoying the beautiful objects some of them are. There's some very well-designed things. And just enjoying that without any feeling of wanting. So, well, renunciation in that sort of way is a kind of death. It's not really a death. It's a movement into life. Most of us are avoiding life by not accepting death, if you see what I mean. Because we don't accept death, we don't really live. So we live for things that are not actually that significant. We live for goods, we live for acquiring people, we live for acquiring status. All of which has to go, all of which you can't take with you. And yet, life delivers us such glory, such wonder, such abundance. Yes, and a almost pleasurable sadness, a melancholy that the fading aspect of life can deliver you. So yes, the Buddha said that we need to take death into our lives and recognise the ever presence of the possibility of death. I've seen this with Sangharakshita. He's 85, and every time I see him, we talk about the Dhamma, we talk about things in our movement, talk about literature, lots of good things. In a sense, he's really very much alive. But he always, sometime or other, will say something like, well, you know, we'll see, well, maybe we won't. He'll say, well, you know, goodbye, I hope we meet again. So he's obviously, completely unmorbid or frightened. He's just completely reconciled to the fact that he doesn't know how long he's got. He's carrying on doing things. He's not exactly making plans, but he's got ideas, things that he's working with. But he knows that he may not conclude them. It's, of course, in a way easier when you're 85. But we need to sort of take that into our lives at younger periods, because it can come at any time. And when we do take it in, it's a liberation. It liberates us from the tyranny of a life that is full of false goals, false ideals, false possibilities. It tells us what life really is, so we can live it fully and joyfully. Then the Buddha said, yes, we need to recognise and reflect on, he says we should reflect on this regularly, we should reflect on the fact that whatever is precious to us, we're going to have to leave. Either because it leaves us, or because we leave it. Whether forcibly or voluntarily, it's all going to go. As they say, you can't take it with you. So again, it's not that then leaves you with a feeling of emptiness. Oh dear, there's nothing I can own, nothing I can possess. You don't need to possess. Possession is insecurity. There's a famous story in the Pali Canon of a monk, a young monk, who's sitting in the forest, and he's meditating, and every now and again he says, ah, oh, it's bliss, it's bliss. And some of the other monks overhear him, and they go to the Buddha and tell on him. They say, you know, that monk over there, he's sitting in the forest saying, tis bliss, tis bliss. What he's doing is he's remembering his past life, because he was a king, he was a prince. And, he's remembering the palace, he's remembering the dancing girls, he's remembering the power, he's remembering the elephants and all the rest of it. And, so he's sitting there thinking, oh, yeah, gosh, it was great. Oh, what a wonderful elephant and how glorious that victory was. And so the Buddha said, okay, well, ask him to come and see me and let's inquire, let's look into it. The Buddha was never one to take things at their surface value. So the monk the monk comes, so the Buddha said, you know, you've been caught sitting there meditating and saying, it is bliss, what's going on? And he said, well, I'm remembering my past. So the other monk said, got it. And he's saying, I'm remembering my past life, and I'm remembering that I used to sit in my palace, and I was surrounded by guards, and those guards were surrounded by a wall, and that wall was surrounded by guards, those guards were surrounded by a camp, that camp was surrounded by another wall, and that my fourfold army was arrayed around it, and yet I lived in fear and trembling. Whenever I heard a rattle at the window, whenever I heard a footfall, I did not know whether it was not my enemies come to take me. So I lived in terror, I lived in fear, although I had everything that a king could have. Though I said unto this man, go and come and he cometh, and that man, go and he goeth, to cross my religions. I still lived in fear and insecurity. And he said, the lesson for me is possession is insecurity. And now I live free. I just need a robe to cover my body. I just need the root of a tree to sit under, to meditate. I just need a village nearby where I can beg for a little bit of food. I just need my friends in the Dhamma to teach me the Dhamma and to go on begging round together with, to share my experience with. That's all I need, and I've got it all at will, at pleasure, without any effort on my part. So yes, when we contemplate the fact that what we're attached to has to be taken from us, it's not so that we end up with a kind of despair, a despondency, or even depression. What's it all for? It's worthless. It's all going to be taken from me. So that you concentrate again on developing the things that are really worthwhile. The things that, in a way, you can take with you. I came across another set of reflections that were the 10 reflections for one who had gone forth. They're very interesting too. I won't go into those this time. But one of those reflections is you think, when I come to lie on my deathbed, is there anything I will reproach myself with? Will I have gained the qualities that will sustain me, as it were, after my death? So, yes, we need to be not developing attachments. Attachments are inevitable to some extent. But we need to be making sure that we at least balance, if not more than balance, those things that we're attached to with real qualities that, in a certain sense, you could say you can take with you, because they accrue to your karma. They're karmic forces that, according to traditional Buddhist belief, will inform what happens to you after you die. So that what happens to you after you die will be, to some extent, motivated by the qualities that you've established, that you've built up in this life. So that whatever new life arises in dependence on your life this time, and in a way you can't exactly say it's your life, the one that's to come, because you won't remember it. Probably won't remember it. You may do, but you probably won't. But still, it's not your life, because it's the result of what you do. I often think it's actually more like your own child, that you're what you do now is the parent of what will happen to you in the future. I find this both a terrifying and a sort of enlivening thought, that some poor little bugger in another life is going to be suffering from the stupid things I did in this life. So that sort of motivates me a bit. And you won't even know who to curse. You have a sense that what you you want to feel when you actually get to that point. Well, I've done what I did. I did a good life. I lived a good life. I built up some real inner qualities. I built up some virtues I did my best to contribute. Maybe I haven't made a big splash in life, but I have built up something that's, you know, genuine, a human quality. I've contributed to this vast current of evolution that is the underlying sort of meaning of the universe. This struggle for a greater manifestation, this struggle for a greater goodness even, that is the real meaning and purpose of the whole of existence. That I've, through my life, added some manure to that process of growth. And that will both contribute to the larger process in which I'm a participant, and will benefit, you know, the me, as it were, that arises in dependence on this me. So that's what's important. Your bank account will not go with you. Mr. Osborne will get most of it, or a fairly large section of it. If you're lucky, Mr. these times, if you even manage to keep it till that point. You know, yes, you'll be able to leave things to your children if you have them, but you won't be able to take it with you. It won't accrue to you. And much that you're very strongly attached to, that you live your life through, you know, the things in your life that you identify yourself through, family, work, whatever it is different for different people, possessions. Those are all okay. There's nothing wrong with them. And a family, you can communicate some real value through, but you can't take it with you. And so you need to consider that. What are you investing in? You know, this is the time we need to be thinking about good investments and putting something in. Do you know what I mean? Are you investing in things that will really yield value? I won't try and pursue the analogies. Too heartless to abide. So are you putting your efforts into things that really give you some deep satisfaction and that will pass into a future life? So yes, these are the first four reflections. The fifth, which I'll remind you of and remind myself of in the course of it, is in a way the sum total of all that. It's what it all comes down to. I am the owner of my actions, heir of my actions. Actions are the womb from which I have sprung. Actions are my relations, my protectors. Whatever actions I do, good or bad, of these I shall become heir. So yes, I am the owner of my actions. This is, in a way you could say, the absolutely fundamental principle in the Dharma. That what you intentionally do is your responsibility. Moral agency is the beginning of the Dharma. I'm very, very conscious of this again in India, where most of my friends have come from, they're from a Dalit background, very low in the social order. They come from a culture in which they're taught that there's nothing really they can do. They're the sort of victims of their circumstance. They must just accept that. That's all they can do. And what they were taught by their great leader, Dr. Ambedkar, and what we help our Indian friends to teach, is that no, that's not the case. You're a human being, just like anybody else. And to be a human being means that you are morally responsible. It's up to you. It's in your hands. What you do is matters. It contributes to, this larger, more than human process that runs all the way through the whole of existence. This movement towards something better, something higher, something finer. So you are a participant in that process, in that struggle. I am the heir of my actions, so that what we are now is the consequence of what we've done. I think this is the business end of karma, that we're all the time recreating ourselves. You're probably familiar with this as experience in meditation. That's the strongest experience most people get of karma. But you put some effort into developing a wishing of well towards others, and yes, you manage to get something going. You manage to have some genuine feeling. Well, may they be well, may they be happy, and there's a payoff, and often. Not immediate, but often, you know, within some time, you'll experience inside yourself a definite sort of payoff. You feel happier. That's not what Metta Bhavana is about. You're not trying to do that. What you're trying to do is wish well to others. But there is a karmic payoff, if you like. And that you will experience yourself as the heir of your meditation. And every morning when we wake up, we are the heirs of what we've done with our minds in the previous day, but actually, you know, over the course of our lives. We're always building ourselves. And, you know, what we are now is the consequence of what we've done. Of course, it's a consequence of biological factors and so forth, although in Buddhism we'd even say those ultimately are selected, as it were, on the basis of our previous actions at birth. But the main thing is to get hold of the fact that what's going on here, the quality of your mind, the way your mind attends, is all up to you. It's the result of the way you've used your mind. Yes, actions are the womb from which I have sprung. I put it very forcibly, that just as you sprung from your mother's womb, in the physical sense, the mind that you have, I don't know, this must be a richer term than mind, the experience that you have, the experiencing that you have, is the child of your own previous actions. It's the vipaka, the fruit of your previous actions. Actions are my relations. I think probably many of us don't have such a positive view of relations. Relations can seem a bit of a nuisance, but certainly in a more traditional society, and again in my experience in India, relations are your social security system. There's no welfare state. We may not have one here for much longer, but our relatives, you know, if you are sick, your relatives will gather round. They will help you. They just don't even think about it. They just come and help you, as you will go and help them. That's why everybody spends all their time going to weddings. It's a good way of keeping up the relative connections. But so your actions are what come to your aid. That the actions that you performed in your life, when you're in difficulties, will come to your aid. So you're in a tight corner, and what have you got? What have you got in that tight corner? You've got yourself, that's all. And what you often find in that tight corner is that the resources are there or not there. Somebody comes up to you and starts speaking in a threatening way, for instance. And if you've got a good karmic background, you'll be able to do something. Something will come out of you that will, well, at least minimise or find a way out of, or at least take well the unpleasant things that happen. You're left just with your own resources. So yes, actions are your protection in the tight corner. That may be all you've got. You're just left with what you've got. Very, very struck by that. I'm reading some. I go to Hungary to, I think I told you last time, to work with Hungarian Roma gypsies. And I got interested in Hungarian literature, which is a very, very fine literature, much neglected in England. Mm-hmm. Very fine literature. I don't know whether anybody knows of it. Sándor Márai is the best known, Embers. But the one I was reading was Antal Sen. And he's a Jew who converted to Christianity, and in the Second World War he was taken off to the camps. And what people commented who knew him was that he was completely unchanged by the circumstances of the camp. And in fact, because he was a well-known literary figure, through Switzerland, the Germans, the Nazis rather, agreed to release him. But he decided he would not go. He was there with his friends, they depended upon him, and he would stay. And he died actually on the last day of the war in the camps. But you got this feeling of a man who stepped into the most awful, awful situation. And, you know, that I've had a, read again a lot of the literature of what the sort of thing that the Hungarian Jews did experience, as they did all over. And terrible, terrible degradation and degradation and loss of worth and value. And he remained completely unchanged and remained a kind, sensitive, witty, and a sort of optimistic human being. So I thought, well, you know, whatever he'd done, even in that awful situation, it was there for him. So yes, actions are our protection. So the Buddha says, whatever actions I do, whether they're good or bad, of those I shall become heir. And he's really saying, in the end, this is the only consideration that matters. The only thing that counts is whether you act well or not. Again, another literary reference comes to my mind. Spanish literature, Golden Age literature, Calderón de la Barca, playwright. He has a play called Life is a Dream, La Vida es Sueño. And in Life is a Dream, it's a complicated story, I won't spend time telling you it, but a prince is put in a tower because his father believes that he's an astrologer and believes that he's going to usurp the throne. And then his father relents and drugs him and takes him out. And then he goes a bit wild because, of course, he doesn't like what's being done to him. So he's drugged and put back in the tower. So he doesn't know what is real and what is not real. And the climax of the play is where he's released by revolutionaries and he leads them to victory. And he says, I no longer know whether this is real or a dream. I don't know whether I'm dreaming or whether this is reality. But the only thing I know is that I can act well. So that's the sort of sense that we need to have, that no matter what the situation, however drastic, however difficult, we can act well. We can act with integrity, we can act with kindness, with the good intentions to produce from the situation the best that is possible. And if we act well, we will be the legatees, the beneficiaries of those actions. They will transform us, and we will find our own minds emerging in a even more positive, even more subtle, rich, deep way, and we'll be even better able to deal with the vicissitudes of life, no matter what they are. So, in the end, it's karma that we're working with, and that is the basic secret of the Buddha Dhamma, that life, the mechanism of life, the principal mechanism of life, is karma. That you can act, that your actions lead to the modification of your own mind in accordance with the way you act. They also lead to a modification of your relationship with the world around you, which may come back to you externally. But that's a rather more complex question. You do know that karma will modify how you are, who you are. And you'll be able, from that more positive, more refined, more subtle, more open, more rich, more imaginative self that emerges, you'll be able to act even more skillfully. So a spiral, a progression can take place, can lead on from this progressive action of karma. And that then leaves you open to the Dharma. It leaves you open to the forces of the Buddha's enlightenment, which can then work through you because you've created the basis for them. So, yes, we need to absorb very, very clearly that the principal issue of our lives is karma. We can't avoid aging. We can't avoid getting sick. We can't avoid dying. We cannot take with us the things that are dear to us. But the one thing we can guarantee is that our own actions will build for us a better mind, a better self, and that is enduring. That passes even beyond death, if you can stretch to that. If you can't stretch to that, we'll build you at least a better life within this life. And that is the only worthwhile basis. That through karma, through good action, life will become richer, more fulfilling, more satisfying, more beneficial. So these are the five reflections that the Buddha says we should all engage in. Engage in a very, very positive spirit, as I've indicated, not in a despairing, oh dear, there's no point in it, nihilistic. But a strong sense that it's a progressive trend that runs through life, that we can participate in, we can contribute to, and that can carry us on to greater and greater benefit. But the Buddha said we need to reflect on this, on these five things. We need to reflect not only that these apply to us, we need to reflect that they apply to everybody. They apply to all existence. Everything grows old, gets sick, dies. Well, certainly all human beings, literally, and everything else metaphorically. Everybody must be separated from what's important to them. Everybody is the heir to their actions. It's not just you. So that you not only have a sense of your own karma, you have a sense of your participation in a larger human community, a larger existential community to which you can contribute. So, I hope that I've brought to life a rare corner of the Buddha's teaching that I've never heard expounded. Perhaps it has been, but perhaps it's lain there for 2,500 years, and this is the first time there. But I hope that you'll find it useful. Of course, it's none of it's new, none of it's original at all. But I like the way it's packaged, the way it's put together, and its very powerful relevance to us. So the Buddha said everybody should contemplate this. And of course, in that context of traditional Buddhism, he said monks and nuns, lay men, lay women. But in our own context, everybody, no matter what level of practice they're engaged in, needs to contemplate this, because it gets you down to the heart of the matter, what the whole business is really about, why we're here. It should be taught in schools. It should be taught in schools. I think everybody should be taught karma. We're taught the law of gravity. Why aren't we taught the law of life, which is the law of karma, which is just the same, it's just built into reality, just the same as gravity is. Mm-hmm. And even a bigger law, which is the law of Dharma, that built into life is a current, is a flow that goes on to Buddhahood. That we can, if we build the right karmic basis, participate in.